entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Good morning. Welcome in. It is the best of Downtown on a Sunday morning, the ninth day of the month of June. Rich Kimble and Carrie Haskell here with you. Downtown brought to you this morning and every weekday afternoon by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Two guests on the program this time around because they're lengthy conversations, and we've found over the years that some of our favorite people to have on the show are the working man type of performers. The character actors, the working musicians who maybe had a few hits along the way, but have made their career out of live performances and engaging with an audience. We've got two of those such people here this morning with us, and some great conversations coming up later. Actor Paul Dooley talks about his remarkable career, a stand-up comic, an improviser, one of the co-creators of The Electric Company on PBS, and then, of course, dozens of movies, some 60 of them through the years, made more remarkable by the fact that he didn't make his first until he was 49 years old. Some great stories ahead with actor Paul Dooley, but we begin this morning by revisiting our recent conversation with singer-songwriter Henry Gross, best known for his 1976 smash hit Shannon, but he's so much more than that. A very talented singer-songwriter, performs around the country doing his one-man show, One Hit Wanderer, and was also a founding member of the band Sha-na-na. They were on the cutting edge of that, even before things like Happy Days and American Graffiti, the nostalgia craze that took root in a most unlikely place at Woodstock in the summer of 1969, when Henry was the youngest performer there and, as we learned, had some run-ins with some pretty big names in the music business. Henry, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. I feel like a 2,000-year-old man after you said all that.
Well, you've squeezed a lot into your time on the planet, and that's good stuff. And, well, it makes sense. You had, and you've described it as the perfect setup for a career in rock music, with a dad who was a pharmacist and a mom who was a singer.
Yeah, well, actually, that's right. You're a musician and a singer. It's a match made in heaven to produce a rock and roller.
Well, you got your love of music naturally and early, and then right out of high school, while still in high school, formed Sha-na-na. How did that come to be?
I was in a band that was playing in Greenwich Village and in all those folk clubs. I was at Brooklyn College, and a couple of my buddies in the band were at Columbia University, and they were in a glee club, and these guys did an oldie one night at one of their kind of things. It was kind of a glee club, social club thing called the Columbia Kingsmen, to differentiate it from the Kingsmen who had Louie Louie. And they did an oldie. They actually did Little Darlin'. And the reaction from everybody was insane. And the brother of one of the guys that was in the glee club, an upperclassman named George Leonard, saw this and saw the whole thing. And it was brilliant. He thought, you put three guys up front in gold lame suits, you grease your hair, you do a bunch of 50s rock and roll and doo-wop songs. And they booked, as this glee club, they booked a show called Grease Under the Stars, or The Glory That Was Grease. and they did it on the steps of Low Library at Columbia, and they thought, like their normal shows, normally they had a couple hundred people show up for their shows, and they thought, okay, maybe 500-600 people would come, but it was an outdoor show, and at least 5,000 people jammed the quadrangle, and it was complete bedlam. And the next morning, one of the guys, students and professors were dancing naked in the fountains. It was insane. And the next morning, one of the Kingsmen, a really preppy guy, quit in disgust, and I, of course, joined. And together we put together this love letter to the 1950s we call Sha-na-na. And it was, one of our first shows. We went and played in this club that right after that, we just took the review of that show down to the hippest club in New York. At the time it was called the Steve Paul Scene. And Steve Paul was the manager of Johnny Winter and Edgar Winter. And anyway, he had this really great club where everybody, like Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton, Slim Harpo, Dr. John, and just amazing people were hanging around in there, Alice Cooper. And we went on and tore the place up because it was the middle of psychedelia and everyone was expecting, some group called the Tomato Spaceship. But instead, you know, we went out and just blew their minds because a lot of the kids, you know, a lot of my contemporaries, I was born in 1951, and a lot of my contemporaries really came into music with the Beatles. I had an older sister and a cousin who was about 6 years older, and so she would give me all her records. I was 5 years old, and I was playing all these Elvis Presley records when they came out. You know, she was a big Elvis fan, and so I really came into the music with Elvis and doo-wop was what I was listening to. This was a natural for me, which is why all my records all along, you just played a little Springtime Mama. To me, that's like a doo-wop song, you know. Springtime Mama, you know, it's really just about the vocals, the harmonies and all that, and the good feeling. And that's doo-wop.
You mentioned Jimi Hendrix, and I understand you also you got to meet Jimmy and spend a little time with him.
Well, I knew him before we played at Woodstock. In fact, he came down to the Steve Paul scene to see us, and we knew, you know, I went to Midwood High School in Brooklyn, alma mater of Woody Allen, by the way. And there was a guy in the class that looked just like Jimi Hendrix. His name was Velvet Turner. Velvet actually did an album for some label after Jimmy died, and Velvet is no longer with us. But he was a great guy, a really brilliant artist as a painter, and he, unbeknownst to me, was a great singer, guitar player. But and his stuff is online, so you can't forget that name, Velvet Turner. Anyway, he and I were friends. He sat next to me in the mixed chorus in high school, and he would draw the teacher and people in the class, and they were, you know, they looked like professional paintings. You know, I mean, they looked like photographs. The guy was amazing. And so we remained friends, and I was coming out of a movie theater in Greenwich Village one night, ran into him with Jimmy. And we wound up going upstairs, which I assumed that was Hendrix's apartment, and we just hung out till 5, 6 in the morning. So I knew him, you know, from that. And then, I didn't see him again till he came down to the Steve Paul scene. And then, of course, we opened. We went on right before Jimmy at 7 o'clock in the morning, at Woodstock, and so I saw him again then, and that was the last time I saw him.
So there you were, 18 years old, playing at Woodstock. Was there any sense at the time of how this would be regarded all these years later, that this would be seen in many ways as the seminal event in the history of rock music?
Well, of course not. I mean, you know, we knew. I mean, you have to understand the thing about. That they say about Woodstock is if you remember it, you weren't really there. Well, I saw Jimmy when I got to the festival. We drove all night. It took forever because we were supposed to play Sunday afternoon. So we left, you know, Saturday night around midnight, and we didn't get to the to the hotel in Fernwood, New York, the Holiday Inn, until 9 o'clock in the morning. The roads were all closed, and we had keep saying, no, we're playing. And again, the cops would say, yeah, you're playing. And, you know, right, sure. You know, so finally we got through and we arrived at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning. And I walked into the hotel lobby and the first person I saw was Jimi Hendrix. And he was holding a quart of Jack Daniels. And, you know, he offers me a drink. You know, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning, but you don't turn down arguably the greatest guitarist of the 20th century when he offers you a drink. So, we got pretty drunk, and then I winded up about an hour and a half later. They wanted to take me to the stage because they wanted us available. The stage was a good distance a 10-minute drive, but would have taken 3 hours then, you know. So with all those people, so they wanted to have us by the stage. They actually they took me in this helicopter, which was the only time I've ever been on one since, and. The guy took us straight up, and I was completely drunk at that point. and he took us straight up, and he tilted the helicopter so we could see the people, the 500,000 people. And, you know, it was the most incredible sight I'd ever seen. And, you know, I would have been amazed if not for the fact that the pilot tilted the chopper with the open door, and a couple of people almost fell out.
Oh, jeez.
So we went. You know, he cleverly brought us right back. We didn't get very far. He didn't bother to take us to the stage because it was such a freak out, and that people were really upset. So I went back and saw Jimmy again, who just laughed because when I told him what happened, he saw me. I was freaked out, and he said when I told him, he just laughed because he told me he had no sympathy at all because he had been a paratrooper.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
You know, he was in the 2nd Airborne or something. Anyway. So he just said, have a drink. It'll calm you down. Drinking. And then this is really true. You know, it sounds like nonsense when I say it, but you'll get the punchline. So I'm sitting there, finally another hour later when we're really gone. I mean, the two of us are just gone. And we're sitting at this table and everyone's coming over to say hello to him. And, you know, I was nobody and everyone's talking to Jimmy. And I was there for this and it was really great. And then a guy comes in and says, you know, your car is here. So, you know, I stumble out of the lobby and there it is, like a 1958 Cadillac. And I'm thinking, well, this is cool. So they're going to drive me over there. Good, because I'm not getting in that helicopter again. So I get in the car and we're just about to start to move. It's just the driver in the front and I am like sprawled out in the back seat. And the door opens and a guy slips in next to me. And it's, you know, he's got the round orange sunglasses and the beard. It's Jerry Garcia. and so he looks at me and he can see that I'm completely blitzed, you know, the beyond belief. So, you know, he offers me something to smoke. And as I say in my show, you know, I'm already higher than Kilimanjaro, but you don't turn down arguably the greatest druggie of the 20th century when he offers me something to smoke. So now, as I say, between the Jimmy Scooch and Jerry's hemp, I'm hallucinating. So, I mean, of course, what Jerry had was not any kind of, I mean, I was never a pot smoker. I mean, I never was involved in anything. Doesn't make me better or worse than anybody, but I never, my dad was a pharmacist, and so I stayed very far away from drugs. But anyway, whatever he had there was like anesthesia. and so, this is the funny bit. Apparently, I spent the entire afternoon with Jerry in the, you know, backstage area. And apparently, Jerry was holding court, and, you know, and I was telling my usual bad jokes. But I didn't know this. And the guy that was in my first band, a guy named Carl Fisher, who played bass in my first band when I was like 13 years old, his dad was a gym teacher in Brooklyn. And his summer job was going up to the Catskill Mountains where we played in the summers and, you know, at the resort hotels. So his dad got the job to do security and he hired his son for this cool thing. And Carl was actually doing security in the backstage area. And it was years later that I happened to get someone put us together somehow on the phone. And he told me that I spent the whole day with Jerry Garcia, something I certainly would have bragged of had I known it.
Singer-songwriter Henry Gross, some great stories about Woodstock. And when we come back, we'll talk about his huge hit, Shannon, and what he's doing these days. It's the Best of Downtown on Z62.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Spring is here, and that means biking season. And the experts at Slipping Gears have just what you need. They're the area's premier full-service bike shop, located at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. With outstanding service and a huge stock, they've got the parts, accessories, and the expert advice you need, as well as the fastest repairs around and a great selection of new bikes. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 6, Saturdays, 9 to 5, and you can shop online anytime at slippinggears.com. Slipping Gears, 753 Stillwater Avenue, Bangor.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With the network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Pretty sure this should be considered a public service announcement. So in advance, you're welcome. I just went to the Ground Round in Bangor and had the most amazing food from their special menu. First, I got the Reuben Egg Rolls, which is all the flavors of the classic Reuben sandwich wrapped in a crispy egg roll and served with savory garlic smoky paprika sauce that has this slight kick. It's so good. To go with it, I ordered the Memphis Fries, French fries loaded with pulled pork, drizzled with barbecue sauce, topped with chopped pickles and diced onions. If your mouth is watering right now, head to the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor. GroundRound.com.
Success. For some, it's the result of luck. For the Maine Black Bears, it's the result of planning, determination, and hard work. Success may have brought you financial rewards, and now in many ways, life isn't simpler, it's more complex. Your choices impact more people and can have longer lasting effects than ever before. At ClearPoint Financial, we understand your challenges. We can help navigate today's changing financial landscape and help you pursue your financial goals. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. See what ClearPoint Financial can do for you. Call us today at 307-7718.
Back on the best of downtown on your Sunday morning. Rich Kimble, Carrie Haskell. Let's listen to a bit of Henry Gross. Became his second top 40 hit. Talking to Henry Gross on Downtown. Now, I watched earlier today a grainy video, but man, an incredible guitar solo that you did on Wipeout.
Well, that who knows? That was done at 7 o'clock in the morning. We were, you know, we slept in the, on the iron grating of some U-Haul truck. I mean, for 10 minutes. But it was great because I met Alden Lee, who later on I rekindled a friendship with, because he was close to boy, it sounds like, you know, it sounds, name dropping is awful because it makes you sound like such an ass. But I just did a 2-year tour with Joe Brown, who was George Harrison's best friend, and he's a big star in England. And you know, Joe and Alvin were buddies, and through Joe, when I was over there, I spent a ton of time with the wonderful Alvin Lee before he passed a couple of years ago. And you know, Alvin became a good friend. He came to Nashville, and we spent some time. But I was just very fortunate that I was able to spend so much time in my life with so many great musicians and writers in you know, from the UK and from, you know, in the United States, and just amazingly talented people. You know, I've written songs with I do write songs, and I'm just recording a couple that I wrote with Roger Cook, who wrote Long Cool Woman, mm-hmm. that I'd like to teach the world to sing, and You've Got Your Troubles, I've Got Mine, and I Believe in You. Anyway, a million songs, Rogers. And I also wrote with a guy who retired called Tom DiRocco, who's one of the great Nashville songwriters, and we wrote a lot of really terrific songs. We just wrote and he helped me finish a great one. And so, you know, it's just been, my life has been a dream. I mean, not, you know, like everyone else's. It's been full of aggravation and loss and tragedy, but it's also been a wonderful, professionally, I wasn't the most famous person, but I was able to make enough, you know, enough and do enough shows and, you know, somehow, some way to stay alive and make music for a lifetime.
Well, yeah, after Sha Na Na, a solo career, you got to work with Jim Croce on his I Got a Name album. Talk a little bit, if you can, about your association with Cashman and West and what that did for you.
Well, I actually met Cashman and West at 80, when I left Sha Na Na, which I left, actually, when the end of the story is when I saw Jimmy playing the Star Spangled Banner, I knew immediately that I was going to quit Sha Na Na, because as much as I loved it, it really was it was a show, and it was more of a spectacle, and there was not any, you know, it was really what we were going to do was done. Didn't matter what oldie you played, and it didn't really matter who sang it. It wasn't about new material, and it wasn't about, you know, doing what it is that you do. It was just really being a cover band of the 50s, you know, with a little bit of dancing and whatever. So it was a fun show. But I knew when I watched Jimmy, I'm thinking he's making music only he can make. Mm. I want to make music only I can make. And so I went and tried to get a record. I spent the next year playing little dumps and writing songs, and I finally got enough together, and ABC Dunhill wanted to sign me. And they sent me to Cashman and West to see what they thought. And they said, yeah, great, we'll produce them. And then they decided to use somebody else in California. So Cashman and West were bummed because they wanted to do a record with me. Anyway, when that deal ended, I went back and saw them, and I signed to their production company. It seemed like a month or two later, I was on A&M Records and did an album with Simone and Meet Me on the Corner that were kind of big, you know, hits, you know, top 10 hits, but not in all around the country at once, but they were hits in different cities, you know, like they do very well in different places. Mm. And then the Plug Me Into Something album came out, which was fairly huge. I mean, today it would be considered huge. It sold nearly 500,000 copies, and back then that was not noticed that much.
Right.
These days it would be, you know, almost impossible. But and then, you know, I went on to they moved me onto their own label, which wasn't, in retrospect, probably something they would do again, or I would participate in again if I had a choice. But because they simply weren't, we had Shannon, which was a, you know, huge worldwide hit, but they were a small, you know, they were just a little record company, and they weren't able to really do what they could have done with a record that big.
So I was telling this story earlier, Henry. So I was, I'm 18, summer of 76, and I'm working in radio, and Shannon came out. Of course, we were playing it like crazy, like everybody else loved the song. But I didn't figure it out until, of all people, Casey Kasem told the story one day.
Here we go.
And I thought, God, you're killing me, Casey.
Well, you know, he wasn't saying anything negative about the song.
Oh no,
he was just upset that you know, here was the song about losing a beloved pet. And they were it was a terrible segue they kept making for him. That was between him and his staff. But people always bring it up. And, you know, look, I never met him. I can't speak for, you know, for Casey Kasem. But what's the big deal? You know, it's just a funny thing to mention. But, you know, for me, I was 25 when Shannon was a hit. And I'm 68. And in the middle, I've recorded about 350 songs. And I've got, you know, my own little label that I have 9 songs finished for the next project, and I just do them, and I have a small fan base that has stayed with me, but they love what I do, and so I try and write some things that are a little different, you know. I try and I don't tip my hat to the marketplace, which is fair enough. I mean, I write songs for people my age, you know. I write funny songs. I write serious. I wrote a song called, one of my new songs is called "I Fooled Around and Fell Asleep." I write songs that make you laugh. I wrote one about what I consider to be the state of rock and roll radio, called "Bill Haley, Won't You Please Come Home?" And for those people listening that don't know Bill Haley, in 1955 he had a record called "Rock Around the Clock," that was actually played over the credits of a movie called The Blackboard Jungle.
Right, right. Well, look, I love Shannon. I still love Shannon. When it comes on, whether it's on the radio or whether it's on my mobile device, I crank it up. And I was going to ask you, do you ever regret writing a song that became such a big hit that would require you to keep singing in that falsetto for 4 decades? But, man, you still can nail it. I watched some clips from your One Man Show, and you sound better than you did then.
Well, thank you. You know, this goes back, if you're listening, to having a dad who was a pharmacist. You know, I remember because he had this little drugstore in Brooklyn, and these guys, one night they tunneled through the wall to get to the drugs. And so the point was very well taken to me. for, you know, at me to look what happened there, and you don't want to be involved in that. And so I didn't. And so, you know, if you stay healthy, I mean, I'm vegan. That's a whole other issue. You know, I try not to disturb the planet. I don't eat anything that had a mother, you know, and I just want to leave the place the way I found it as much as possible. And I do preach it, but I understand that people don't all agree, and that's fine. But that's where I'm at, and I try and stay healthy, and I walk 4 or 5 miles a day, and I prefer to sing as long as possible.
Well, and you're also doing Carl Wilson's Dog Proud because you've done a tremendous amount of work through the years as an animal activist.
Yeah, I do. In fact, I'll be doing one on August 8th in Portsmouth, Ohio. This will be the fifth year I'm doing something for Sierra's Haven, which is a no-kill shelter there. We raise money every year for the no-kill shelter there. And, you know, so I try and do whatever I can. You know, I've rescued. I mean, I've probably spent most of the money I've made in my life on animals, you know, on rescuing them and taking care of them. At one point, we had 6 cats and 4 dogs. Yeah, there was not a lot of sleep.
By the way, I've watched the clips from One Hit Wanderer. Man, it looks like such a great show. The stories, the songs that you tell of your career and the business and your life. Is there a certain freedom in not having to worry about writing hits and just, as you said, writing songs for people your age and writing songs that you're inspired to write?
Yeah, well, that's the only way I can go down the road. You know, I didn't sit down with Shannon and, you know, who would write a song about a friend's dog named Shannon. I had an Irish setter named Shannon. Carl actually had a Samoyed named Shannon, and his was hit by a car and killed. But both dogs had this, you know. And I got home and sat with my. Who would write a song about the passing of a beloved pet and expect to have a hit, especially with a, you know, in 1976, the Beach Boys found that kind of song. I wrote it for Carl, so you know I was hoping that they would do it. But then the album 15 Big Ones came out. You know, Brian came back,
right.
And the Beach Boys don't cut outside songs. With the great writers like Mike Love and, you know, and Carl and Brian, they didn't, mostly Brian, but they didn't need any outside songs. So, you know, I just put it out, and Carl loved the record. You know, he was very happy about it. His mom loved the record, Audrey, it was great, you know. It was a good thing. And Springtime Mama sold nearly 1 million copies, and you know, it's just that the record company kind of wasn't able to really do what A&M could have done. So I think it really was. They tried their best, and you know, you in those days, you know what was happening in radio. You had to have a bank.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And, you know, nobody works for free. And, you know, people, you know, took a shot on Shannon. It worked. And, you know, came Springtime Mama. I guess they expected an envelope. I mean, that's what was happening, right? I mean,
right.
Well, what it is. So, you know, it was a huge record anyway, but not nearly what it would have been. I mean, you put that record on. You know, even now, and people will generally get on the phones, you know, when you play that song. And I feel I've been in places where people play it, and then I get people start calling up. And the same thing happens with my new stuff. But it's impossible. There are basically, how many stations are there in the country that will play new material by a guy my age, no matter whether they love it or not? It's immaterial.
Well, you're still making great music, and again, if you go to the website, henrygross.com, you can learn so much more about Henry's music, appearances.
What a buddy you are. What a buddy you are.
Well, it's been great, Henry. Been wonderful talking with you. I've enjoyed your music for, well, more than 40 years now. I used to play Simone a lot back in the day. I love that song.
Oh, man, there you go. That's one of my favorite songs I've ever done, and that was a really good R&B song, and man, that was a hit. That was like number one in Chicago. It went up to top, close to the number one in Chicago. It was a big hit in Washington, Baltimore. There were a bunch of markets where that was a really big record. And, man, I was so proud of that song. There's a great Nashville songwriter called Rick Giles. And when I met him, we sat down to write a song, and he said, "I'm really nervous." I said, "What are you nervous about?" He said, "I used to play Simone in my band." And this was a big hit writer. And I just to realize that I've been so fortunate that my dreams inspired some people. What a lucky me, which is my favorite of my songs anyway.
Henry, it's a great talk. We so much appreciate you making time for us this afternoon. Good luck. Happy trails out there on the road. And hope you'll come back and visit with us again sometime.
Anytime you want, call, just give me a shout, and I'm here. I love to talk music to people that love it.
Singer, songwriter Henry Gross. Fun conversation with him here on the Best of Downtown. When we come back, veteran character actor Paul Dooley joins us. This is Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since 2005, Pineland Farms Dairy has been making the finest cheese in Maine. Our cheddar, Monterey Jack, Pepper Jack, Baby Swiss, feta, and cheese curds are all made with natural milk from Maine. Find Pineland Farms cheese at Hannaford supermarkets, Shaw's, Whole Foods, and other great shops throughout Maine and New England. Visit online at pinelandfarmsdairy.com. Maine cows, Maine milk, Maine cheese, Pineland Farms.
Don't feel like making dinner tonight? Don't worry, Angelo's Pizzeria has got you covered. With locations in Bangor and Hamden, Angelo's is never too far from where you are. Pizza made from the finest ingredients and fresh dough, sandwiches, and subs. Calzones, pasta, chicken, burgers, salads, and more. You can find something for everyone in the family at Angelo's. Give them a call at 942-5553 or stop in at 499 Hammond Street in Bangor or 102 Main Road South in Hamden. That's Angelo's Pizzeria, open daily from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on in to Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Penobscot Theater Company presents Sequins, Spandex, and the Music of ABBA. The sunny and funny, enchanting tale of love, laughter, and friendship. Mamma Mia! At Bangor's Historic Opera House, June 13th through July 14th. Tickets at 942-3333 and PenobscotTheater.org. Walk in. Dance out.
Back on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning.
I just can't help believing when she smiles up soft and gentle.
Our next guest on Downtown has had a remarkable career as a stand-up comedian, a writer, improviser, and a star of a number of movies and television shows, TV programs like Grace Under Fire, ALF, Curb Your Enthusiasm, movies including Breaking Away, 16 Candles, Popeye, Runaway Bride, and Cars. We had a wonderful time talking recently with character actor Paul Dooley. You have done so much in your life. I don't even know where to begin, but I guess the beginning sounds like a pretty good spot. And the fact that people may not be aware that before you got into acting and comedy, that you were a cartoonist as a young man.
That's right. It wasn't a very professional calling. It was mostly local, but I did have comic strips in my college humor magazine and my hometown paper and my high school paper. I was highly influenced by a cartoonist who created Snuffy Smith about hillbillies. Mm-hmm. And I'm from West Virginia, where they even actually have hillbillies. So my strip is about a couple of hillbilly guys, Zeke and Zeb.
You served in the Navy, and then you began doing stand-up along with some stage work, and you were quite successful as a stand-up comedian, several appearances on The Tonight Show, but not with Johnny Carson. You were on with Jack Parr.
Yeah, it goes a long way back. Once a guy said to me, who was the host? I said, I was on before Johnny Carson. I said, who was the host then? I said, Marconi. An inventor of radio.
We love Marconi in our business, absolutely.
Yeah, I did about 2.5 years of stand-up, and I really hated being on the road because I had kids at home, and, you know, it's lonely in the hotels, and half the time the audience is hostile, you know. I always did well in New York, and I played the Playboy clubs, and certain out-of-town gigs were okay, but sometimes they didn't know what the heck I was talking about. My act was a parody of Shakespeare. I'm not sure anybody knew what the parody was about.
Well,
but anyway,
you decided it would
I had
be
a chance at some point in the middle of this tour of stand-up to join Second City, where I could look at another actor and see his eyes and do comedy with him, and I liked that much better.
Well, and that would serve you well later on in your film career and in television, where you got to work with some people who enjoyed the whole art of improvisation, the idea that you go in with a blank slate, but you... I think this is such great training for any actor, because the whole idea behind it is to make your scene partner look good.
Yeah, that's right. And not be afraid on stage and never be nervous. I was. Everybody has a little nervousness about like an opening night or something if you're on stage. But once you've been 2 or 3 years in Second City, nothing makes you scared. You'd go on any night and do anything, and I would hope for a mistake in the script so that I could ad-lib, you know. I would love something to happen to the lines with other actors, because then I could improvise. It's my favorite thing. And, of course, I worked with Christopher Guest three times in a number of his movies, and I worked with Larry David, who improvises. And even Robert Altman, who did five films with me, and he admires improvisation, so he doesn't mind that at all.
Well, you also got a big help in your career from a guy who was pretty good at improv as well when he partnered up with Elaine May. Can you talk a little bit about the role of Mike Nichols in your career?
Well, I was went to an audition, and I was in Second City in the New York chapter at that time. And I heard once in a while that Mike and Elaine, either together or separately, had come in to look at us because they were living in New York at the time. And they're all... their whole background is improv, and they didn't always come backstage, but they would show up often with different friends, not together necessarily. And so I didn't really know that they had ever seen me. I just knew once in a while they came in. But when I went to audition for The Odd Couple by Neil Simon, which Mike directed, I did the reading of the normal pages you use for your audition. And he came down and he said, you know that thing you do at Second City where you're playing an evangelist trying to sell fallout shelters door to door? I said, yeah. He said, well, that was terrific. Could you do some of that for us? I said, I don't know, Mike. It's a matter of having the questions that the other actor, you know, doing it without the other lines that the other actor would give you. Because it wasn't an improv. It was something which had been created through improv and then became a standard scene. I said, it might be a little difficult to just do those parts without the other guy. He said, oh, that's okay, never mind. So I say goodbye. I go out the stage door. I go out the alley. I'm going up toward the street. And it never happens. I hardly ever hear about this happening. But the stage manager runs after me and says, you got the job. So that was fun.
And you were an understudy for Art Carney, and then you stepped in when Art Carney left the production.
That's right. Art at that time was drinking, and he was a little bit of an alcoholic. And so once we arrived in New York, we had a little out-of-town tour for maybe 6 weeks, and he never missed a performance. But when we got to town, he started missing like one a week or something. So by the time I really took over for him, I had appeared like in a one time only, a night at a time, maybe, I don't know, 10 or 12 times. So I was pretty familiar with the lines and everything. And then we found out that Art, he would miss a lot. And then he didn't come in, and they didn't come in for 3 days without telling us where he was. And everybody's concerned about him, and they couldn't find him. And they found that he had put himself into a rehab situation for his drinking. But he never returned to the show after that. But we did do about a year with him. But anyway, I enjoyed it very much. It's one of his great plays, and every time somebody opens their mouth, it's a laugh. The straight lines are funny, and the punchlines are funny.
We're talking with Paul Dooley here on Downtown. You also played an important role as a co-creator and writer for one of the great children's programs of all time, The Electric Company. I understand that you were responsible for coming up with some of those great names like Morgan Freeman's Easy Reader, Fargo, North Dakota. Those were your idea. That's fantastic.
Well, they called in a bunch of writers, and I never knew why they called any of us, but some of them had a history of writing for radio for ad agencies. And I had done a ton of radio with some of my partners from Second City, where at first we just improved people's regular writing on radio by putting in the final last line and making it into an ending with a joke. And we'd always make them a little bit better than they were. And after a while, we decided we're going to start charging for the creative part of it, the writing part. So we formed a little company. We did over 20 years, about 1,000 radio commercials, some written by other people, but mostly written by us, and all coming out of improvisation. We would improvise at home and write them down and take them in and let them take a look at it, and then we'd record them. But it became like mother's milk. We could do, in weeks, we could do, 10 or 12 or 15 radio spots. And they were all Second City people.
And did you do, am I right that you did a commercial, and I don't know if it was radio or television, with one of your heroes, Buster Keaton?
That's right. And he's the reason I wanted to become an actor. Saw him on old films when I was 15, and I said, oh, my God. In addition to his great comedy and acrobatics, he's a wonderful actor without words. And I just fell in love with his character. And about 30 years later, I did a commercial with him for Ford Econoline Vans. Played a Keystone Cop. Was one of the thrills of my lifetime.
You mentioned your association with Robert Altman, several films with him, starting with A Wedding. You were also part of the experience on Malta, I believe, making Popeye, yeah, where you did an amazing job as Wimpy. What was that experience like?
Well, it was like living in another, not just country, but another world. The scene designer, who was one of the best set designs I've ever seen, created that town from scratch. There was nothing there, just a little bay. It wasn't even like a sandy beach on a bay. It was all rubble kind of rocks, and if you were to walk on that area, you'd step down two steps and then up three steps and then down four steps. It was hardly possible to walk over. So we built an entire town with not facades, but four walls to these houses. You had about, 15 or 20 of them. And then we got new lumber from Canada and built it, and they all look brand new, except the sagging roofs, And then he aged them to look 100 years old, like a whaling village off New England or something. And it was just really, really wonderful. And the name of that town is Sweet Haven in the comic strip. Mm. And when the actors talk about it now, or even any time during and after, we never felt we lived in Malta in the little bungalows that we had. We felt we lived in Sweet Haven because we'd spend 12 hours of the day there and go back, go eat, and then go home to sleep. So we felt where we really lived was in this mythical town of Sweet Haven.
Yep.
It was just a great thing. There were 50 actors, and one was more talented than the other, and we got so bored with that little country where there's nothing to see or do. There's not one tree on it. It's a big rock. And so we put on a variety show at some point to amuse ourselves, and it lasted 4 hours. That's how many people contributed and how many people had things to do. And Robin emceed it, and by emceeing, he didn't just introduce people. He came out as somebody. He was Ed Sullivan, and then he came out as an evangelist, and he came out as an Englishman and a Frenchman. He emceed it by coming out about 15 times introducing acts.
And Harry Nilsson was part of that group too, right?
He was there, and he wrote the music, and they were terrific songs. They have a kind of a childlike quality to them, which is appropriate because so many people who read the comics are kids. And You know, there's a song that she loves me, he 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 loves me. And all the repetitions sound almost like a kid's song. And Bluto sang, I mean, you know what I mean, I mean, I mean. And I thought they were charming, very, very charming.
One of my favorite performances of yours, Breaking Away, absolutely one of my top 10 movies of all time. That was just such an incredible cast. Dennis Quaid, I think, in his first role, Daniel Stern, Dennis Christopher. That had to be a wonderful experience for you.
Jackie Earle Haley.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's been my calling card ever since, because when I go to an audition, which I don't do much anymore, but I go to meetings to meet with directors, and the first thing they say, even though they might be 30 years old, is, God, I love that movie. And because when they were in film school, they probably saw it. That's what a lot of people have told me. So they're always complimenting me on my performance and saying how much they love the movie. And I do think it was perfectly cast. And it also took an Englishman, the director, Peter Yates, and Steve Tesich, who was from Yugoslavia and came over here when he was a kid, to look at America and try to see what America culture was like in the Midwest, which I thought was amazing. They really pinned it down, and they're not even American-born.
We're talking with Paul Dooley here on Downtown. You mentioned the films you've done with Christopher Guest, and I understand you had a little connection to Chris through his mother.
She was my agent for a while.
That helps, right?
Yeah, Jean Guest. And also, I was in Death Wish for the original Death Wish number one for one day shooting. And Chris, partly because his mother is a casting director and an agent, he had a one day part too as a young rookie cop. And then a little before that, somebody asked the Second City Actors in New York to do a thing for PBS. Like an hour and a half show, all using sketches. And they didn't want to do it with us ad-libbing on camera. People are afraid they're waste too much time ad-libbing on camera. And then they'll have a hard time cutting it because of the overlap. So they said, take 2 weeks and make up anything you want to, and then we'll film it. And so Chris Guest was in it for just a few minutes, but he was playing a guitar in the background, and he really was just in it almost like a day or two. But he was playing the guitar even then, and he had a few funny lines that he made up because the whole thing came out of improv. And that was it's called Nice Place to Visit. It's about tourists, about people in New York, people who are visiting.
Chance to show off those improv skills again, working with Larry David in a very memorable role on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Now, what did you get from Larry David? Obviously not a script. Was it just a setup of the scene and what was happening?
Not even a setup, just told you what the scene's about. And a script is for an hour show, let's say, might be 60 pages. And 30 pages for a sitcom, and this was like 6 pages. And it would be like a paragraph saying, I remember one of them said, Larry has gone to the movies with his wife, and he comes home, and his in-laws, and I was his father-in-law, his in-laws are there playing some sort of a board game, or playing something like Home Jeopardy or something. And I remember one of our lines was, is hard on a real word. Can you use it in the game of words? Anyway, the scene quickly descends into whatever he wants to talk about. In a normal improv situation, you're both creating the dialogue, and it can be your combined stories. But I always felt it was our job with Larry David to make him look good and make him go where he wanted to go, and we just followed rather than leading. They have a term called follow the follower, which means nobody's leading and no one's following. You just give and take until you have something. But most of the people who worked there just did stuff that would make it easier for Larry to be his character. So often we were just saying, come on, Larry, you can't say that. Because he was always saying the wrong thing. And people say, is he hard to work with, because they think his character is hard to get along with. But the truth is, he's easy to work with. It's not in his interest to insult his cast. It's in his interest to keep them happy and let them enjoy themselves. So he's a very sweet guy, nice guy, fun to work with. And he accepts what he gets. He doesn't go say, let's do it again and don't say that. You know, he just knows he can chip away at it in editing anyway.
You did a one-man show last year called Movie Dad, because you've played a lot of dads in your career. You've played them in your real life as a father of four. What do you think are those qualities about you that have made you so successful at playing fathers?
I don't know. I don't know if it's a matter of having done it successfully, like beginning with The Wedding and went on to Breaking Away, and then not too much longer after Popeye, I did 16 Candles. And maybe it's just a matter of getting typed by the parts you've just been given, kind of based on your age or something. But I really don't have an answer why people think I'm a good dad. I guess I show a certain amount of empathy at times, but also I play cranky old dads, you know, who who you know don't get along with their kids. It's true. I've done. I have about 30. And I have a list in my file called All My Children, and they're about 30. People I've been the father of, including Philip Seymour.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He was 16. I played his father in a movie.
I understand your own.
I thought later, if I knew how famous he was going to be, I'd have been nicer to him.
I understand, but your own dad, though, was perhaps on the stoic side.
He was. He was so much like the Breaking Away guy that he was always, you know, kind of, he was not a zinger guy because he didn't talk very much, but he was, he never smiled, you know. He was one of the hardworking guys in a factory. He used to come home and put his lunchbox down, go out to his workshop. An hour later, my mother would call him for dinner. But he spent very little time, as little time as he could with the wife or the kids, you know. He worked hard and he went home and to sleep. I rely on him a lot when I do characters, especially if they're not agreeable.
Well, we have loved so many roles throughout your long career. We are so glad to see you continue to be working, taking on great challenges out there. I know you got a talented family. Your wife is an awfully good writer as well. So we wish you a continued success and good health, and really appreciate you making time for us this afternoon.
Well, it's my pleasure, and if she only wrote one thing, she'd be famous. She wrote the musical Wicked.
Right. That's a pretty good start right there.
Now she's working on the screenplay of Wicked, which will come out in a couple of years.
That is Paul Dooley here on The Best of Downtown, wrapping it up on a Sunday morning. You guys like Paul Dooley, Henry Gross. Hey, listen to those guys tell stories all day.
Yeah, there's something about, and we've talked about it so many times, these guys that are working on the road and working job to job, their observations and their storytelling about those jobs is just amazing to hear.
Absolutely. Two good ones there. Our thanks to Paul Dooley and Henry Gross for being with us. Thanks to you for joining us, too. Tomorrow on the program, actress Sally Struthers will visit with us. So we'll talk All in the Family, Gilmore Girls, but talk about why she comes back to Maine every summer to perform down at the Ogunquit Playhouse, her connection with that theater and with the state. Also, Ryan Hannibal of WEEI on the Red Sox. Author Catherine Eban discusses her book, Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. And movie reviews with Alan Adams of The Maine Edge. Have a great rest of your Sunday. We'll catch you tomorrow afternoon at 4 right here on Downtown. Tonight, downtown, you're